leaving Jesus Christ out of the equation. If we were asked who is our favorite New Testament character, I think two names would probably emerge at the top of the list. One would be Peter, and the other would be Paul. And of those two, the Apostle Peter very often is said to be our favorite character. And one of the reasons most often given for the Apostle Peter being our favorite character is that he is so much like us. And we're thinking, of course, of the record that we have of Peter in the Gospels. And we are familiar with his foibles and his failures. We are familiar with his denial and his humanity. And then we look at Paul and we say, oh, but look how zealous Paul was. We know we don't quite measure up to Paul. And so Peter might even be chosen over Paul, though Paul wrote the majority of the New Testament. But if when we think about Peter, all we remember is the record of his foibles and his failures from the Gospels. And if we think that those foibles and failures are continuing in his life, when he writes 1st and 2nd Peter, I suggest that we are doing a great injustice to the Apostle Peter. The truth of the matter is, when we come into the book of Acts, the Apostle Peter has become the person to whom Jesus said, "And I say unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." And on the day of Pentecost, it was the Apostle Peter who stood and preached the first gospel sermon, and was the first man to publicly invite people to come to Jesus Christ. In the early chapters, we find Peter taking the lead along with John in the preaching and proclamation of the gospel, and even in receiving persecution for the proclamation of that gospel. He and John were very close, as revealed somewhat in the gospels and certainly in the opening chapters of the book of Acts. He and the Apostle Paul took the lead in what is often referred to as the Jerusalem Conference in Acts chapter 15. And Peter and Paul were close. We'll talk more about that as we proceed in the introduction this morning. But when Paul wrote Galatians chapter 2 and verse 9, we find they were still together. The epistles of the Apostle Peter are significant epistles, though they are brief and only form a small part of the New Testament. In fact, one commentator referred to 1 Peter as the most condensed New Testament resume of Christian faith and the conduct that it inspires. In this letter, the Apostle Peter seeks to encourage, he seeks to reassure the Christians in Asia Minor in the face of impending persecution. And certainly the Apostle Peter talks to all of us when he talks about present suffering but future glory. We usually associate that concept with Paul, for he says that the sufferings of this life cannot be compared with the glory that is to be. But this is perhaps the entire theme of the epistle that bears Peter's name, the first written by him. And a strange thing, when Peter comes to encourage these Christians in Asia Minor in the face of impending suffering, he doesn't do so like a lot of us moderns would like. We want some kind of Norman Vincent Peale feel good type sermon. But when it came time for Peter to encourage these Christians in Asia Minor, he did so by instructing them. And it is the instruction upon which his encouragement is based. Peter recognized that our deepest needs give rise to our deepest beliefs. And he knew that in the face of impending persecution, that what these Christians in Asia Minor needed was hope. And so Peter declares Jesus Christ as our sure hope, both now and forever. And throughout his letter, his first letter, he grounds our hope in the reality of what God has done for us in and through Jesus Christ. And Peter knew all of this firsthand. Peter was a witness to all of these things, not just what Jesus said and did in Peter's fishing boat or in Peter's house, but he was a witness to the meaning of Christ's life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. And Peter's record of these events is probably, note that word, included in the gospel that bears the name of Mark. Many scholars believe that Mark's record in the gospel found its original source in the Apostle Peter. And you will find as we go through 1 Peter that Mark was with Peter when 1 Peter was written. And in this first letter, he shows us what this story of Jesus Christ means. When Christ called upon us to take up our cross and follow him. And Peter knew those words. Peter heard those words. And they are recorded in Mark chapter 8 and verse 34. But the question is, did Peter really write this letter? There are a lot of folks who say no. They say that Peter on this letter is simply a pseudonym for the fellow that wrote it. And as was commonly the practice, people would sit down and they would write something and, well, they're not going to read it if Jess Hall wrote it. So Jess Hall sits down to write and he says, I, the Apostle Peter, send this letter to you. Because if Peter wrote it, people are going to read it. And these deniers of Peter's authorship further suggest that to the early church, this would have been just a minor matter if what was in it was okay. But I suggest that that is not true. Because when you go through and read a lot of early writings, you discover that there are a number of books that bear the name of Peter which have been rejected because they were not and clearly not written by him. And it was never a small thing to claim apostolic authority when you didn't have it. Apostolic authority came from and through Jesus Christ. That's the only way it came. And if you don't believe that it was defended vigorously, then you just go back and read some of the attacks that were made on the apostolic authority of the Apostle Paul and read his vigorous defense of his apostolic authority. It was no small thing to the early church or to any Christian anywhere, anytime, to have a book begin with a lie. I, Peter, wrote this when it wasn't Peter writing. It was never, ever a small thing. The book claims that Peter wrote the book. The attestation outside of Scripture that Peter wrote the book is early and it is strong. The earliest reference is in 2 Peter 3:1. Assuming Peter wrote that book, he says, "This is my second letter." And so that is a reference to the first, saying that Peter wrote that book. Clement of Rome, who wrote before the end of the first century, quotes from 1 Peter in his writings, though he does not name the book from which he's quoting. And we all know that's not that unusual. Preachers quote Scripture all the time without citation and without saying this is from Romans or 1 Peter or whatever. Or they make comments that are clearly from Scripture, but without naming the book. Irenaeus, writing in the 2nd century, expressly attributes his quotations to the epistle by name. So early and strong are the attestations outside of Scripture that the Apostle Peter is the author of this book. Those who deny the authorship make four basic arguments, other than the one we've already discussed. And these are based on the content of the book. Number one, they say, well, the Greek style is too polished for a Galilean fisherman. There is in the writings of one of the early church fathers by name Papias a reference to Mark as Peter's interpreter. And the folks who take this position say that that really means Mark was Peter's translator. And Peter needed a translator because Peter didn't know Greek. That's number one. Number two, we talked about the persecutions mentioned in the book. And it is suggested that these persecutions were not at the right time for Peter to have been written by Peter at the time it is said that it was written. That the persecution by Nero came later. These persecutions came after Peter's death. And so the book had to be written after Peter's death. Thirdly, the letter said to be too much like Paul's writings to have come from the Apostle Peter. And fourthly, even when people recognize significant differences between Paul's writing and Peter's writing in 1 Peter, they maintain nevertheless that Peter's letter just contains what they call traditional teaching and materials from the early church, and it's not the kind of letter that one of the first disciples of Jesus and an apostle would have written. Let's look at those arguments, and we're going to take them in reverse order. First, this last objection, that the material is just general teaching of the church and not the type that an early disciple or an apostle would have written. Let's recall that we've already established, and we know from Scripture, that Peter was an eyewitness to the words and deeds of Jesus. And his record of that probably had already been made in Mark's gospel. And I suggest that when Papias referred to Mark as Peter's interpreter, that is what he was referring to. So in 1 Peter, the story of Jesus and the things of Jesus' life are assumed, and Peter is concerned to instruct the church in the apostolic interpretation of the gospel. And so the purpose of the letter dictates the contents of the letter. And so the contents of the letter are certainly consistent with apostolic teaching. And if you don't believe that, just compare some of what Peter writes with what Paul wrote, because they definitely have some of the same subjects discussed in their writings. And we'll talk more about that in this next objection. This letter is too much like Paul's letter. Well, you've got two apostles writing. You've got two inspired men writing. And you have two people writing who are striving to, as Paul described it in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 13, to hold forth the pattern of sound doctrine or sound teaching. So if you have sound teaching, it is obvious that there are going to be some similarities in points, in language, and maybe even in words. But there are significant differences, just to mention one. The Apostle Paul does not use the servant of the Lord as Peter uses it in describing the work of Jesus Christ in his life. But the truth is, it would be surprising if letters written near the end of Peter's life did not have similarities in thought and even in words to some of Paul's writings. And one reason for that is that if the historical traditions reported by Eusebius and Tertullian are true, then the Apostle Peter, near the end of his life, was teaching with Paul in the city of Rome. In addition to that, when the Apostle Peter identifies those who are with him, one of those individuals is referred to as Silvanus, who was the messenger who carried the letter. Silvanus is another name for Silas, who was a longtime companion of the Apostle Paul. So the affinities between the writings of Peter and Paul weigh more in the favor of Peter's authorship than against it. But what about the persecutions Peter describes? Did they come after Peter's death, and therefore the letter must have been written by somebody else? That objection assumes that the persecution to which Peter makes reference is the persecution under Nero. Now, it's true that it was under the persecution of Nero that both Peter and Paul met their deaths. It is also true that the persecution of Nero was the first great government-sponsored persecution that spread throughout the entire Roman Empire. But it is not true that 1 Peter reflects a condition of governmental and general oppression. When you read 1 Peter closely, it's clear that it's referring to a time of local harassment, it's referring to a time of sporadic persecution, a time in which Christians are warned to prepare for greater sufferings and for Christ's return and sake in the future. In fact, Peter's specific directive toward the government, we'll see in the second chapter, verses 13 and 14, is you be subject to the government. His comment concerning the king in the 17th verse, or the Caesar, is that you honor the Caesar. Peter does not specify one type of suffering. Instead, he encourages these people to be prepared for various types of suffering. Look at chapter 1 and verse 6. All of the other statements about suffering in 1 Peter can be understood as general statements addressed to Christians where there was a likelihood of localized persecution. We shouldn't be surprised, because this was not something unusual for Asia Minor, first century Christians, because from the first spread of the gospel there had been violence and violent opposition in many places. And we'll talk a little more about that when we get to chapter 4 and verse 12, when Peter talks about the fiery ordeal that is to come upon you. So, the letter cannot be said to reflect necessarily a persecution after Peter had died. In fact, what we read in the book is entirely consistent with what we know of the times that existed in Peter's lifetime. And then finally we get to the first objection. And this may be the one that people think most about. Peter was a Galilean fisherman. It is doubtful that Galilean fishermen went very far in sea. And so Peter generally is considered to be an uneducated Galilean fisherman. Well, given that that is the case, and given that Peter was raised in Galilee, and given that Peter was uneducated, how much Greek could he have known? We need a little history. 400 years before the time of the Apostle Peter, there was a little known fellow by the name of, you may recognize him, Alexander the Great. And in 332 B.C., he conquered that area. And a process of Hellenization began. And that simply means that a process began to impose upon that conquered area the culture and the language of Greece. And it continued for four centuries. So by the time the Apostle Peter wrote his first letter, the area in which he lived had had four centuries of exposure to Greek influence. In fact, there were many Greek cities, especially in and around Galilee. Joppa, down on the coast, had been a center of Greek influence for many years. The 10 cities called the Decapolis were within easy traveling distance. In addition to that, there were newer cities such as Caesarea, the administrative capital of Judea, Antipatris, Sebaste, which was ancient Samaria, Neapolis, Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee, and Caesarea Philippi were more or less thoroughly Greek cities peopled mainly by non-Jews, and using Greek as their everyday language. In addition to that, there is substantial ancient evidence of the use of Greek in Palestine. There are hundreds of Jewish ossuaries that have been discovered, stone coffins in which the bones of the dead were placed. And they've been uncovered all in and around Jerusalem, and they date from the first century A.D. or earlier. Of the ossuaries discovered in Jerusalem, 97 of them are in Hebrew or Aramaic. 64 of them are in Greek. And 14 of them are bilingual. Now, one of these days, when I'm in the coffin, I hope to have a tombstone. And I hope my family, this is notice to them because I'm sitting here. I hope my family doesn't put my name on my tombstone in French or in Russian or in Polish or even in Spanish, though it's spoken to a great extent in our area. And don't you assume that when the people put the names of their loved ones on these ossuaries, that they did so in the language with which they were familiar and that they spoke. A good percentage of them are in Greek and bilingual. In addition, there's a large plaque from the entrance to the temple in Jerusalem that was unearthed in the 19th century, and it dated from before 70 AD, and it warned all Jews not to enter, all non-Jews I should say, not to enter beyond that point, and it was written only in Greek. Now, while it's true that this certainly doesn't prove absolutely that the Jews spoke Greek, it does demonstrate that the Jews believed that all the Gentiles in the area spoke Greek, because it was only written in Greek. Further, one can assume that with these Gentiles living there and the Jews living there, that they had some relationship in their daily lives. And to have that relationship in their daily lives, it's also reasonable to assume that many of these Jews came to speak Greek to communicate with these Gentiles. Even more remarkable is a Greek inscription that commemorated the work of the ruler of the synagogue, the ruler who was both a priest, presumably in the temple in Jerusalem, and the son and the grandson of synagogue rulers. That a memorial plaque on the wall of a Jewish synagogue in Jerusalem could be written in Greek shows how thoroughly the use of the Greek language had penetrated even to the center of Judaism in Palestine at or before the time of the New Testament. Public decrees were written in Greek and posted around for all to read. A passage in the Babylonian Talmud implies a large interest in Greek and Hellenization, because it suggests that in the school of Gamaliel, a name with which we're familiar because Paul went there, of 1,000 students, 500 studied the Talmud and 500 studied Greek wisdom. So all this demonstrates that it would not have been unusual for Peter to have used Greek regularly for over 30 years in the Jerusalem church and earlier in speaking Greek with Gentiles in Galilee, and to have become very familiar with the Greek translation of the Old Testament known as the Septuagint, which we know he did because that's the version he uses when he quotes the Old Testament in 1 Peter. But you say, could someone who didn't have a formal education really learn Greek that would be necessary to write the very good Greek that we find in 1 Peter? How many of you know what a tinker is? Got one. We talk about tinkering around. A tinker is a repairer of household pots and pans. How many of you ever heard of a tinker from Bedford? Would it help you if I told you that Bedford was in England? Would it help you if I told you that his name was John Bunyan? Would it help you if I told you that this uneducated Bedford tinker wrote Pilgrim's Progress? Can an uneducated person, without formal education, I should say, You can be educated without formal education, and you can be a fool with it. Many people have demonstrated both of those truths. Yes, you can. How many of you ever heard of Joseph Conrad? Would it help you if I told you that he lived 1857 to 1924? Joseph Conrad's first language was Polish. As a young man, he learned French. He started to learn English when he signed on to a British ship when he was 21 years of age. And he bragged, "I have never opened an English grammar." Yep. An uneducated, formerly uneducated man can do great things even in a language that is not his first. Joseph Conrad gave us the English classic Lord Jim. And finally, we ought never to forget that when the opponents of the gospel in the early days of the church looked upon Peter and were astonished at his ability because they knew he was an uneducated Galilean bishop. Acts chapter 4 and verse 13 tells us they took note that he had been with Jesus. Clearly, the Apostle Peter is the author of this book. To whom was it written? Peter tells us. The dispersion, Pontius, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia are the provinces where the addressees of this letter live. Now, we're not sure whether this refers to Roman provinces or to regions. If it refers to Roman provinces, then it's Asia Minor, probably most of modern Turkey. If it is to regions, then it is a smaller area, and it would not overlap as much the area that we know to have been where Paul journeyed on his missionary journeys. For instance, Antioch of Pisidia, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe would not be included. We do know that Paul was forbidden to go into Bithynia, and Peter is writing to those in Bithynia among the others. Could it have been that Bithynia was reserved for someone else to proclaim the gospel in? The church historian Eusebius suggests that Peter established the churches to which he was writing this letter. I don't know that that's true, and it may be that the only evidence Eusebius had for that was the fact that Peter addressed the letter to them. But nevertheless, that suggestion has been made. The big issue is whether the Apostle Peter wrote to Jewish or Gentile Christians. That's been debated for years and years and years. I suggest to you that if Peter was writing to Jewish Christians, they must have been Jews in name only. In chapter 1 and verse 18, the Apostle Peter speaks of the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers. Now that's a common description of Gentiles, but not of Jews. In chapter 4 and verse 3, he describes that wicked lifestyle in a manner consistent with Gentile lifestyle, but not characteristic of Jewish lifestyle. And even if the Jews had lived in that manner, it's unlikely that it would have been handed down to them by their fathers. Their pagan neighbors would hardly be surprised if the Jews returned to the normal moral lifestyle of Judaism. So I think it's fairly clear that the letter was written to predominantly Gentile congregations. Oh, but somebody says it made extensive use of the Old Testament. So what? It's clear that Paul wrote to predominantly Gentile congregations, and he also made extensive use of the Old Testament. So that which proves too much proves nothing. Where and when was it written? Where it was written depends on whether Babylon is literal or figurative. Babylon of Mesopotamia was the capital of the ancient Babylonian Empire. By the time of the first century, it was so deserted as to be called a great desert. Strabo wrote around 19 AD. I think he died in 19 AD. So it's unlikely that it's a reference to that city. There's no little Babylon over in Egypt that really doesn't come into consideration. We do know that the name Babylon is used in Revelation. And by the way, our master of the bell has started ringing, so I'm sort of hurrying through here. If you want to get the entire notes to an audio of this lesson, you'll see at the bottom of the introduction outline, this brief handout, a reference to the website www.thywordistruth.com. And the audio that I'm now giving will be recorded and will be placed on that website. And the entire notes that I'm using this morning, if you want to just read through them and have them, you can get and print off from www.thywordistruth.com, and you can get them just as soon as Eric finds time to post them. It is his website. He maintains it. He lets me contribute to it. It's a very fine website. If you haven't been there, you ought to go. And he gets hits from all over the world on that website. It's a good way to proclaim the gospel. So you may get the entire notes there, and it'll be easy. I think he's worked to make it user-friendly. But just as in the Old Testament, Babylon was the center of opposition to everything holy and to God and God's people, so in the New Testament, Rome had taken that position. And so it seems that Babylon is used figuratively and is a reference to Rome. There's historical evidence that Peter was in Rome at the end of his life. Tertullian referred to it in 203 AD. The quote will be on the website. Eusebius, the church historian, supplemented Tertullian in writing in 325 AD, and he referred back to a writing of Dionysius, bishop of Corinth, who died around AD 170, who affirmed in this passage of his correspondence with the Romans, "By so great an admonition you bound together the foundations of the Romans and Corinthians by Peter and Paul, for both of them taught in Italy in the same place and were martyred at the same time." Eusebius continues, again, that quote will be there. And finally, Eusebius explicitly states that Peter wrote his first letter in Rome, and he refers to Papias, and it's in this book by Papias he refers to it and says that he wrote it from Rome. These testimonies, I think, taken together indicate that Peter and Paul both died in the persecution under Nero. It lasted from the time of the great fire in AD 64 to June the 9th, 68 AD. And that was the great Neronian persecution. So that tells us approximately when the letter had to be written. And I suggest that it was written sometime in 63 or in the early part of 64 before the persecution of Nero began. The purpose of the letter. Many of Peter's exhortations concern faith and obedience, and the purpose of the letter appears to be to encourage the readers to grow in their trust in God and their obedience to Him throughout their lives, but especially when they suffer. To remember that, you might just make a note to look at 1 Peter 4 and verse 19, because these themes are there. Wherefore, let them also that suffer according to the will of God commit their souls in well-doing unto a faithful Creator. Them that suffer, there's the theme of suffering. Trust in God, it's according to the will of God, and should result in continual entrusting of the reader's souls to a faithful Creator. And this should result in obedience. Let me conclude with a brief statement by one commentator that I think maybe this sums up this introduction. This excellent epistle, full of evangelical doctrine and apostolic authority, is a brief and yet very clear summary both of the consolations and instructions needful for the encouragement and direction of a Christian in his journey to heaven, elevating his thoughts and desires to that happiness, and strengthening him against all opposition in the way, both that of corruption within and temptation and afflictions from without. The heads of doctrine contained in it are many, but the main that are most insisted on are these three: faith, obedience, and patience. To establish them in believing, to direct them in doing, and to comfort them in suffering. So ends our introduction. Next Lord's Day morning, chapter 1.